We will continue now with Brother David Rice, considering the nominal systems.
But dear brethren, we'll start our consideration of the prophecies about the nominal systems from Revelation, the 14th chapter. Revelation 14, which is, you all know, is the time of harvest. And we're going to look starting at verse 7. It says, saying with a loud voice, this is one of the angelic messages that pronounces the harvest, fear God, give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come. And in verse 8, there followed another angel saying, Babylon has fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. So the fall of Babylon, or the judgment of Christendom, the nominal systems, really has been transpiring for a long number of years already, ever since the harvest opened. Now let's just reflect a little bit and see what has occurred, and then project as to what might still be ahead of us. When the Brother Russell started his ministry in the 1870s, there was no earth-shaking, radical movement in Christendom that disrupted the nations. Now, as somebody has mentioned, there was in the Ottoman Empire, and there was in the Turkish-Russian War, but in Christendom itself proper, really what there was for 40 years was the spread of the truth. This was a problem to Christendom. This was a message they couldn't answer. This was something that stumped them. This was a burden to them, but it really did not decimate them except draw out people from them, as the expression was, come out of her, my people, in chapter 18. Following that, we have World War I, which really did disrupt Christendom in a very radical way. And one of the things that it did, other than just weaken the nations, was it showed a sham to all of their prospects. Before World War I, by and large, most of Christendom had thought they were onward and upward to the conversion of the world and peace in our times, and that everything would be better than it was before. With World War I, that concept pretty much was taken out of the mainstream of Christendom's thought. As a matter of fact, after World War I, they really had no good answers. What's going to come next? I don't know. It doesn't look like too good a momentum is building here. Everything's kind of degrading. And following that, following the kind of stymied of all of their hopes and ambitions, you had something occur in Christendom that kind of sapped the life out of all of them, and that was the modernist theories. Since their old views didn't seem to hold water, modernism kind of pervasively took over. And the mainline Christian churches today are largely filled with modernist concepts that dispute the very integrity of the gospel message itself at its very heart. Maybe Jesus was a good teacher, maybe the Son of God, but they don't have much of the heart of the gospel left there anymore. Well, following that, we had World War II. World War II continued what World War I did in breaking down the nations of Christendom, but it did something more. It put a burden on papacy that they had never seen before. After World War II, you know what happened? Russia, one of the Allies, swarmed into Middle and Eastern Europe and basically clamped down on that area that had been the stronghold of great papacy. Now, during the 60s, while they were under the thumb of that institution, was it Pope John said the church seems fated to die? Today, I don't think the Pope would say that, because things have turned a little better. But papacy underwent a real difficult problem. So what is next on the horizon? What is next ahead of us? Well, if you go to the book of Jeremiah, the 50th chapter, I think you can see a review of some of the things that have already occurred and an indication of what still lies ahead. In Jeremiah 50, there is a breakdown of the various judgments that would come upon Christendom, upon Babylon. And starting with about verse 35, we see these judgments expressed as swords upon Babylon. The first one is upon the Chaldeans and the inhabitants of Babylon. It kind of reminds you of what happened with the onset of the harvest. Present truth began a work that was really a difficulty for those in Christendom. But the next sword is upon the chief stays, the chief bars and supports of Christendom. World War I maybe have been a fulfillment of that. And the next sword is upon the chief leaders, the mighty men who are kind of dismayed. They don't know where to turn next. And then their horses are next judged, their doctrines. It's almost like they don't know where to turn next. And after that, the very heart and soul of Great Babylon is robbed. Their treasures are robbed. Kind of reminds you of the afflictions of papacy for the last couple of decades. So what comes next? That's the question. And in Jeremiah, it says, the next thing coming. is a great drought upon the river Euphrates. Her waters will be dried. Now that reminds you of something, I hope, in Revelation. That reminds you of what Revelation said will occur just before the climax of affairs. And that's where we're going to turn now, to Revelation, the 16th chapter, to learn something about this drought which dries up the great river Euphrates. Revelation 16 says, we're at verse 12, that the great river Euphrates was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon and the beast and the false prophet. Now, where are we in the stream of time when this problem emerges? Well, in one sense, you could say the river Euphrates, the sources that have supported Christendom, have been drying for a long time. That's true. And yet this seems to be, in context, placed at a point in which is rather the culmination of a long process of difficulty Christendom has been undergoing. And as a result, as a reaction, as a response to the withering of the river Euphrates, which has supported Christendom, Babylon, for so many years, there is a decided position that is taken. There is a coalition of beast, dragon, and false prophet. That's stated very clearly, but what is not so clear is what these three items mean. But I think most of the brethren would probably concur that the beast here is the same one in chapter 13. It's described all the same way. And chapter 13 is the papal beast. And most brethren look at this and say, that's papacy. I think that's a correct thought. Now you've got the dragon. You say, well, that's Satan. Well, that's a little bit too general, because Satan is described many ways. Satan is the old deceiver, that's the serpent. Satan is the accuser, that's the devil. Satan is the opposer. That's Satan, that's the word Satan itself. And he's also the dragon. So as the dragon is opposed to the other titles, we find he is the tyrant usurper of the powers of this earth. And that's why most brethren, when they read this dragon, they think of Satan's control over the uncivil systems of this world. And I think that's true. I think that's the Ahab part that supports Jezebel. But now we've got this third component, and the third component is the one that, to me personally, helped me resolve the time sequence of this narrative. The third component is the false prophet. The false prophet, most of the brethren agree, this is in the fourth volume, 1912 forward, pretty clear, the false prophet represents something like amalgamated Protestant Federation. But that's pretty general. Who are some of the members that are included in this false prophet? Well, let's turn quickly to Revelation, the 19th chapter, and see the demise of this great false prophet. By the way, Revelation 16 is the very first time we ever encounter that expression. So false prophet appears in 16, the very first time it ever appears in Revelation. But now let's go to Revelation 19, where it tells us in verse 20 that the beast is taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. So in verse 20, when it says papacy is finally destroyed, it says the false prophet, Protestant systems federated together, are destroyed at the same time. But then it identifies that false prophet as the same as the one that wrought miracles before the beast. You know, the one that had deceived those that had the mark of the beast. And it almost says it as though we should know who that's all about. We should, if we study verse by verse through Revelation, because that has come up before. That has come up before in chapter 13 of Revelation. And we won't read it. We'll just remind you that in chapter 13, it says that after papacy rose up out of the sea, another beast came up with two horns, and that's the one that deceived those that dwell on the earth because of its miracles, and that's the one that deceived them that had the mark of the beast. That's the two-horned beast. So the false prophet is something that relates to the two-horned beast. Two-horned beast, I think most brethren would say, that's the Church of England that acted just like papacy. And, of course, England also had an associate, Ireland, for many, many years. That's why it was two-horned. Now, how does this help us understand anything about what's going to happen? For this reason. If Revelation 16 says there is some time when papacy and the Church of England are going to be in some coalition, some rapprochement, however strong or weak it may be, then our task of understanding the passage is a little simplified. We look back in history to see when did the Church of Rome and the Church of England, which was a counterfeit Church of Rome, as it were, when did they ever begin to come back into sync with each other? Well, from the time they split in the 1500s, there was no rapprochement until modern times. And as far as I know, if anybody knows different, please let me know, because I'd like to be informed here. As far as I know, there was no hint of rapprochement until after the middle of the century. In 1948, there was a system formed called the World Council of Churches. It was formed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, which, like the Pope, is the head of his church, head of the Church of England. And he amalgamated to himself, federated together, a lot of mainline Protestant denominations, but the Archbishop of Canterbury was at the head. Since that time, there has been more and more a rapprochement between that organization and the papacy. And even independent of that, there has been more and more in recent times a desire in the part of the Church of England and the papacy to bridge the differences that have been some centuries standing. Can they bridge those? Not totally. The scriptures never say they are one system. They say they lean to each other for some mutual support. Well, what are some of the problems they've got? Well, the biggest one, of course, is the Catholic Church recognizes the Pope as the head of all Christian churches. It might be a while before the Church of England adopts that position, that the Pope is their head. I don't think that'll ever happen, and that's a real sticky point. That's a thorny point, you might say. And there's another problem. Some of their Church of England has been much more liberalized, and they've admitted women into the ministry, and the Church of Rome probably is not likely to do that. Probably they never will amalgamate. This scripture says they will lean to each other more and more before the last final demise comes. Because that process seems to be ongoing in our day, and we look back in history and we don't see any fulfillment of the Church of England and the Church of Rome coalescing in the past, it induces us to believe that this prophecy has not reached its climax as yet. Now, one time years ago, when we really began to get into the prophetic word deeply, we were quite undecided on this issue. But it is this point of looking for a coalition between the Church of Rome and the Church of England that induced us to see that this seems not to yet have climaxed. So we think that this is ahead of us. Now, what happens when this comes? That's a major question. Some brethren will say when this coalition is formed, it will be a strong and powerful coalition that may even mean the death and martyrdom of the saints who do not agree. Others will say, acknowledged historically, this has not occurred. But when it does, Christendom is so lifeless and anti-withdrawn from power, it'll be a very weak coalition, it'll be a very weak union. They're just leaning for collective support because they're so weak. And it'll be a passing problem, but it would prefigure their end, but it will not be the major, precipitous climax of church power that sometimes we have kind of expected. Where's the truth in this? I think it's somewhere in the middle. But where the truth is on this point is harder to determine than exactly when this prophecy applies in the stream of time. I think this prophecy has not yet reached its climax. And as we see this farther and farther progressing toward ecumenicalism, we can see it closer and closer to climax. Well, what happens when it does? In Revelation 16, it tells us what happens next. It says in verse 13, "There are three unclean spirits like frogs that come out of the mouth of the dragon and the beast and the false prophet, and they are the spirits of devils working miracles, which go forth to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty." And immediately precedes, therefore, the utter destruction of Christendom. Now, you see that in Jeremiah 50 as well. You see that after the drought dries up the powers of those that have supported Christendom, the next thing in order in Jeremiah 50 is utter desolation as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And that's what you got coming up. You've got the final demise of Greek Christendom that seems still to be edging before us. Now, what follows in Revelation 16, verses 16 through 21, is a symbolic representation of what still remains. There are two things that are primarily in focus here. One is that there is an assemblage to battle. And the other is that following this, there will be a great earthquake. Verse 18, there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. The great city was divided into three parts. Well, that makes sense. The great city, Christendom, had three parts. They coalesced in three parts, the beast, dragon, and false prophet. So now this union will not stand. It will break into three parts. And then it says, this, King James, the cities of the nations, Sinaitic manuscript, the city of the nations. Who is the city of the nations but this great Babylon that has ruled the nations for so long? The city of the nations came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. And every island fled away, the mountains were not found. There was a great hail out of heaven about the weight of 100 pounds, hailstones, that's pretty big, and suggesting the very hard-cutting truth will finally sweep away the refuge of lies and finally bring in the kingdom. So we've got a two-pronged attack here on Christendom. We got a battle, and then we've got an earthquake. Now, where do we ever see a two-pronged climax to the end of old Christendom? We find it in type, way back in the Old Testament. You may remember that when Elijah teached the world that it was not the old systems of Babylon that were God's representative, but it is a new incoming kingdom established by God's grace through Israel.